41. Every 9 years. After 9 years of marriage, my husband asked me for a divorce. Well, he didn't really ask. Not directly. I was starring on stage in Claudia Allen's Cahoots, a madcap comedy at Chicago's Victory Gardens Theater. She had written the play with me in mind. I wasn't all that busy in May of 2000, so I gratefully said yes. All of the buzz and crazy predictions about Y2K, the arrival of a new century, had been nothing more than a dull fizzle. At the moment, it resembled my career. I had no TV show, no TV movie, and no manager. Then Ron Meyer, by now my agent for 2 decades, decided to leave Creative Artists Agency for an executive career at Universal Studios. He was the only agent I knew, so I left CAA when he did. It seemed I was soon to be a candidate for one of those mawkish "Where Are They Now?" cable shows. They would find me in a 99-seat theater on the north side of Chicago with my extra 30 pounds of menopausal weight. I had no idea how to define myself anymore, and I couldn't visualize my future. At the same time, Barney could no longer see his future with me in it. One night, following the show, sitting in the little apartment provided by the theater, I had a hunch, an intuitive hit. Text messaging had just become a thing in 2000, and I typed in my question to Barney, who was happily ensconced in our Fisher Island apartment in Florida. I typed, "Do you want a divorce?" He replied a moment later. Barney sent back, "Where did you get that?" I responded, "I just did. I picked it up. It's what I do." I waited for the reply, which came back. "Yes, I am thinking about it. Your radar still scares me." It wasn't a shock to me. We had been arguing more frequently and making up less and less. Indifference had come to define us. I'd always known deep down that I made a much better mistress than a wife. During one of our many arguments, right before I left for Chicago, Barney told me of a prediction about the two of us made by his ex-wife years ago. "Barbara said you and I would never make it, because we both want to be the star of the show." I snapped back, "Well, Barbara was wrong. We will never make it, because I am the star of the show." Barney couldn't help but grin. "Touché," he said, retreating to his desk. Barney had been married twice before. His first wife, Joni, was only 20 when they married, 29 when they divorced. His second wife, Barbara, was barely 30 when they married, 39 when they divorced. He had never been married to a woman of my age or my temperament. He had survived 9 years with me being a menopausal mess, and I had lived an equal amount of time with him being a major asshole. What a pair. Now he wanted out. One day, in the middle of a fight, I yelled at Barney, "Don't you think it's fascinating that every 9 years you divorce a wife?" I swear, he paused, looked up at the ceiling, doing the math in his head, and then his voice, filled with wonder, answered, "It is fascinating." What a jerk. I am a saint. He is still alive. One could no longer contest a divorce by the year 2000, of course, but that didn't stop me from acting like I could. Completely furious with him, I said, "All right, I'll give you your divorce, but not until I make it to year 10, because I'm going to beat out the other two. After that, I don't give a fuck what you do." "It's a deal," he said. Months later, I flew into Los Angeles for the big family dinner to celebrate our 10th wedding anniversary. Barney has never failed to plan and host perfect parties. He took over the private dining room at Mateo's restaurant on LA's West Side. Everything was impeccable. He seated himself at one end of the table and me at the other, obviously all the better for us to look adoringly at one another, through the tunnel of faces of our family gathered there to celebrate us. Not one of them, not one, knew we were getting divorced. Barney rose to his feet to propose a toast. There I sat, with yet another unfortunate perm topping my almost 200-pound body, thinking, this ought to be good. Barney raised his glass to me, smiled, and announced in my direction, "To the winner!" God, the fucking arrogance. He still makes me laugh. And he still finds himself fascinating. Forty-two. I love trouble. Oh, for a dose of trouble. I live for it. Give me a character with some spirit, I'll jump in with both feet. Among many other roles, I've played a vulnerable receptionist, a virginal daughter, a slutty co-ed, a spoiled heiress, a square hospital administrator, an observant artist, a variety of doomed stewardesses, a bold cop, a sassy hotel owner, a funny sex education teacher, a determined journalist, a famous movie star, and a mutilating nurse. But I had never played a powerful queen, and I had never played a character from the 12th century. Eleanor of Aquitaine was both. I had accepted the female lead in The Lion in Winter, to be produced at the Cape Playhouse in Massachusetts, one of the oldest theaters in summer stock. At the time I was offered Eleanor, I was still in Chicago starring in Cahoots. I probably should have turned down the role, but I didn't really want to go back to Miami and face the divorce proceedings. Instead, I sought to engage the finest acting coach in Chicago, and I found him. I knew my life would change with Peter Forrester in it, and that's exactly what happened. He is brilliant, very funny, and we got it about one another. We became fast friends forever. I still wasn't convinced the part was right for me. I would be playing Eleanor at a time when I felt my personal worst, overweight, prone to mood-swinging depression, soon to be a divorcee, with shriveling self-esteem. Not a good look on me. Come to think of it, Eleanor's life was not dissimilar, but she handled it better. One afternoon, before I went to the theater for Cahoots, Peter called me from his office. Peter was also an agent for actors. He had a script. "Have you heard of a TV show called Queer as Folk? It's a British show that's been bought by Showtime to make a U.S. version." I had not heard of it. "There's a part in it that's perfect for you. I'm going to send a driver to bring you a script. Please read it right away." I did read it. I picked up the phone, and I called Showtime. Carol Smith was now working for Jerry Ofsay, the president and programming head of the Showtime network. I asked her if the role of the mother had been cast. She said, "You don't want to play the mother." I said, "Yes, I do." She said, "It's cable. There's no money." "I don't care," I answered. Carol sighed. "It would be filming in Canada. You don't want to live in Canada." I was unflappable. "Yes, I do." I wasn't going to give up my shot at playing this part. I had never responded to a role on the page as fully as I responded to Debbie Novotny. Besides which, I had never read a complete TV script like this one before, with its blatant sex scenes. Carol told me she would run it by Jerry, who happened to be in a casting meeting that very day for Queer as Folk. Jerry got on the phone with me. "Sharon, I love this idea," he told me. "I think you'll bring a little class to the project." I said, "Jerry, class is not what I had in mind." I knew exactly what I wanted to do as Debbie Novotny. She had great honesty, guts, and fierceness, and I loved every word that came out of her mouth. Jerry said, "Would you mind if we flew you out to Los Angeles to meet with the two producers, Ron Cowan and Dan Lippman? It's their show." I agreed. On my way to the airport, I spoke to Ron and Dan on the phone. "Before I fly out there, do you both know what I look like now?" Dan said, We saw you on stage with Tyne Daly for the recent AIDS benefit. We know exactly what you look like. Even if they didn't know what I looked like, I wasn't about to let go of an opportunity because of my size. I had done that once before, and it remains one of the greatest regrets in my life. In 1996, Barney, Tyne, and I were getting ready to do a promotional tour for the Cagney and Lacey reunion movies on CBS. I was dreadfully unhappy. I've been trying to eat away my menopausal depression, and now I look like a plus-size version of Cagney. Angela Lansbury called, personally. She said they had written a 2-hour episode of Murder, She Wrote, with me in mind, and she wanted me to play the lead guest star. I had told Angela for years that I wanted to work with her. It was a lovely offer. I was an emotional mess. I stammered out, Angela, I'm so sorry. I'd give anything to work with you, but I am committed to this press tour with Barney and Tyne for our 4 TV movies. What was impossible was for me to honestly tell Angela what I'd looked like at that time. I was terrified she would see me in person and regret asking me to guest star. I didn't have the nerve to tell her. It would have been such an honor to work with Angela. My great loss. I know we would have been good together. This time around, with Queer as Folk, I was going to put it all on the table beforehand. Take me or leave me. There was a larger version of Sharon Gless, still an actress, still ready to work, still good at what I do. So I flew out on my day off from the theater. I wore a T-shirt that said, Christ is coming, look busy. It was the most wonderful interview. We never stopped laughing. I fell in love with Ron and Dan. You have Debbie's laugh, Dan told me. The part was offered to me that day. If I wanted it, I wanted it. At that time, I was with a new agent, David Shapira. I told David, I just went and met the producers of Queer as Folk. Before I could say anything else, he shot back, I would never let you do that filthy show. I said, well, I already got the filthy part, so negotiate the deal, please. He did. And get me out of The Lion in Winter, please. Thank you. He did. I knew people would remember Debbie Novotny on Queer as Folk. She was wonderfully real and hysterically funny. I had no idea how many people would watch it. We only have one worry, Ron said. We know your background. In your past TV shows, you've been the lead. This will be different. This show is not about Debbie Novotny. I said, I understand that. I smiled, thinking to myself, wait till I get on screen. Pride cometh before the fall. I was so enthusiastic about playing Debbie Novotny that I devised a complete look for her. There was a novelty shop in West Hollywood that sold T-shirts with raunchy remarks printed across the chest. I bought out their stock that referred to gay sex. I went to a wig shop in Hollywood and procured 17 different wigs in a variety of colors from hot pink to emerald green. I had already made up a backstory for Debbie, for my own purpose, about how her goal was to buy her own beauty shop. She worked at the Liberty Diner during high school, got pregnant, and couldn't go on to beauty school because she had a baby son to raise. The producers loved the T-shirt idea, and the wardrobe department made me a rainbow vest. I modeled each of the wigs for the hair and makeup people. Ron and Dan told me, we ran the wigs idea by the executives at Showtime. They're against the variety of wigs. They wanted the viewers to know that it was Sharon Gless. I felt like saying, Jesus, the second I open my mouth, they're going to know who it is. I was allowed to pick one wig. I chose the red one. Then, the thing that Ron and Dan were concerned might happen, did happen. It was my first day of shooting. The show was already in production for about 2 weeks in August before I came in. I was given a call time of 11 a.m., I arrived on the set and got into costume, wig, and makeup. Every actor on the show had a small dressing room with a makeup mirror over a counter, a bathroom, and a couch. It was fine with me. I knew the deal when I signed on. So, Once I was ready, I went to my dressing room, sat on my little couch with my script, and waited to do my scene. I am never late. 1 hour passed, then three more, then it was midnight. At 5 a.m., I was finally called to the set to shoot my scene. I had been waiting for 18 hours. The director did nothing at all to make Debbie Novotny's introduction to the viewer special. The scene takes place in the diner. My son Michael comes in with a new kid, Justin. Debbie nicknames him Sunshine. I had some fun ideas of how to introduce Debbie to the viewers. The director didn't care. He barely made eye contact with me, was uninterested in any suggestion I had, and basically treated me as if I were a person who had never been on a soundstage before. I tried to keep my cool, but I was infuriated by his arrogance and lack of imagination. Clearly, I had a dose of arrogance myself. I had been trained early on in my career that at the end of a day of filming, you never leave the set without personally thanking the director. It was a tradition. I had always honored it. Until that morning. Instead, as soon as we were wrapped, I phoned my agent. After that, I went to Ron and Dan's office with my complaint. They had one too. About me. They were unhappy that I had called my agent. They were sympathetic, but it was complicated. A lot was on the line for them with this 2-hour launch episode. They pretty much let me know that they had warned me, and they had. I was in tears. The truth was, I didn't understand their key concerns. I had not played a supporting role for decades. I had always been on one of the major networks. I had never done a cable show. I was clueless about the way it might transpire. I didn't identify it on that day in Ron and Dan's office, but now it's evident to me. This leading lady had to adjust to becoming a supporting player. It was a harsh wake-up call for me, like a cold shower at a campground when you're used to a jacuzzi tub at the Four Seasons. I took a deep breath, tamped down my residual anger, and then said, "Here's my request. I will wait for as many hours as the director needs to get his shit together until he gets to my scene. However, once I'm on the soundstage and it's my time on camera, you have to give me time to work. Don't rush my scene because you got yourselves in a bind. Please." That was my only ask. They agreed. I never complained again for the entire 5-year run, and neither did they. Showtime did a screening of the pilot for an invited audience in Los Angeles. Barney went with me. He was stunned that I would let myself appear in a TV show looking like that. I was overweight and wearing a cheap red wig and gaudy clothes. He thought it was a career crusher and let me know it. I didn't have the same worry. I knew I had reinvented my career with the most interesting female television role available that year. The people who attended the screening applauded my scenes and came to talk to me afterward. They fell for Debbie as hard as I had. I knew TV viewers would have the same reaction. When the lights came up, Barney said, "I was wrong. It works. They love you." Then he added, "But that director certainly didn't know how to introduce you." I appreciated his apology. Often interviewers will ask me why I wanted to be in Queer as Folk. I always tell them I did it because I thought there would be trouble. And I love trouble. And I will thank Jerry Offsay, Ron Cohen, and Dan Lipman for the rest of my life for letting me in. They brought me back, and for 5 years we made wonderful memories. I'll be there. I had to tell Michael he was gay so he didn't have to tell me first. Debbie Novotny says these words to Justin's mother after she returns the teenage runaway back to his front door. Over the years, many people have told me how much they loved that line from Queer as Folk. I didn't write the line. I wrote none of Debbie's dialogue. I didn't alter a word. I was just the lucky one who got to say it. It's why I wanted to play this character. I knew she could cause change. One morning, during the first week of filming, Michelle Clooney, who plays Melanie, was in the makeup trailer at the same time I was. When she was finished, she stopped by my chair on her way out. "None of us would have done this show," Michelle told me with tears in her eyes. "We were all so afraid they would end our careers because the content is so shocking. But then we heard you were going to be in it. We all decided that if Sharon Gless thought it was worth the risk, then we could do it too." I was both flattered and floored. Ironically, I'd done the show because I thought it would help my career. Filming that first episode, we all knew that we had signed on for a groundbreaker. In those days, truly daring TV shows about gay life didn't exist. TV studios usually wanted a safe and popular hit. When you sign on for something radical and new, there is no safety net. There was no Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or the L Word when we debuted. Those shows didn't appear until years later. Somebody had to be brave enough to start it. Jerry Ofsay, Showtime president, took the chance. I think everyone who worked on Queer as Folk held their breath the night the show premiered. We expected backlash from the religious right or strong warning reviews, maybe a petition or two against Showtime. We didn't hear a peep. Unbelievably, our premiere happened on the very night that George W. Bush stole the election from Al Gore in Florida. The religious right was focused on their political victory. The rest of America was stunned and sad. The show slid in under the radar and stayed relatively unnoticed by the press until it gained an audience and momentum. The producers had anticipated that gay people would find the show, but their expected audience numbers doubled. It became a pop culture phenomenon. Showtime discovered that heterosexual women were making Queer as Folk appointment TV. They watched by the scores, intrigued by the sexy and beautiful men. Then their boyfriends would watch with them, hoping for payoff with their turned-on girlfriends. Viewers may have first tuned in out of curiosity about the sex scenes, but they stayed fans for all 5 years because the show had heart, loyal and tumultuous relationships, and ever-evolving friendships. Okay, it had great sex, too. Only the actors and the camera operator were allowed on the set during filming of any scene involving sex. Believe me, I tried to inconspicuously watch, but the director would always laugh and say, "Sharon, go to your room." These actors were not exhibitionists. They were real actors, and they courageously gave full life to each character. Because we were all far away from home, the cast became very close. It was an intimate show, and our friendships reflected that intimacy. We are still close to this day. One of my all-time favorite scenes was with Gail Harold, who played Brian. Debbie had heard that Brian lost his job, and she goes to his loft to comfort him. She arrives with a tuna casserole in hand to find Brian sitting on the floor stoned. Despite admitting that she hasn't smoked pot since Woodstock, Debbie joins Brian on the floor to share a joint. The last time I had smoked pot was in the early 1980s. All I remembered about being stoned was that there were always long gaps in the conversation. At the table read for this episode, I said to Gail, "Let's make this scene how it really is when you're stoned, okay?" Gail nodded, "Following your lead." We read the scene with a 6 to 10 second pause between each line. The actors, producers, and writers at the table broke into laughter and then applauded at the end. As the relationships developed season to season, it became obvious that Debbie had a potent power over Brian. She could call him on his shit like no one else could. He is vulnerable to her in ways that he never is with other characters. And God love Gail, he was willing to go there with me every time. Right before our final season, Rosie O'Donnell was shooting a movie in Toronto and was working with crew members from Queer as Folk. She told them she loved the show and wanted to be on it, Of course, everyone thought it was a great idea. Rosie had certain caveats, however. She told the producers that she did not want to play herself and that all of her scenes had to be with Sharon Gless. They honored her wishes. Rosie played Loretta, a woman who escaped an abusive marriage, came to work in the diner, and fell for Debbie. She brings her roses and homemade candy. Debbie thinks it's a sweet gesture of friendship. Peter Page's character, Emmett, gives Debbie the wake-up call that Loretta's feelings are romantic. Then, one evening, after three drinks, Debbie leans in to kiss Loretta. The next day, she has no memory of what she did. Loretta hasn't forgotten. Rosie was in three episodes. She was wonderful. Later, she sent me a dozen red roses with a card that read, "You're a good kisser." I was flattered. It was the first time I had heard that from a woman. But then again, it was the first time I had ever kissed a woman. I've had gay friends my entire adult life. But until I was on Queer as Folk, I didn't know a lot about the struggles and concerns of the gay community. Debbie was a true advocate and activist. As a PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, mom, she knew the issues. I learned quickly what they were. Ever since Queer as Folk, gay men will approach me as I am leaving events, movie theaters, restaurants, or even on the street to ask if I will give them a hug. I'm always happy to do that. Many will express how often they had wished to be accepted by their parents. Once I embraced a young man and he started weeping in my arms. I stood and held him thinking, my God, the damage that has been done to this boy. I've never consciously adopted as my own the principles of a character in the way that I adopted Debbie Novotny's. She was a bold advocate for gay and lesbian rights, and I learned a great deal from her. Anytime the gay community needs me, I'll be there. One of the first things I did after the show wrapped was to accept Rosie O'Donnell's invitation to be a guest on her second Our Family Vacations cruise. She and her then-wife Kelly wanted to provide an opportunity for the gay community to take a vacation with their kids, friends, and other families like their own. Rosie chartered a complete cruise ship. It was an instant hit. She made a sensational 2-hour documentary on the Virgin Cruise. It was nominated for 5 Emmys. For years, Rosie lived part-time on the island next to Fisher Island in Florida. I would ferry to the bridge and walk to her house. We'd talk for hours. She's smart and funny, as well as very politically savvy. I liked her more and more every time we hung out together. We were having dinner one night, and I said, "Ro, I love you so much. I mean, do you think I didn't even know what I was expecting. She was married. I was married. I was obviously confused. She was not. Rosie smiled and said, "Oh, Glessy, no. Never. You are so straight." I was disappointed and very relieved. So for all of you who thought since the first episode of Cagney and Lacey that I was gay, well, I gave it my best fucking shot with the number one lesbian on the planet. And she turned me down flat. Apparently there were complaints. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they count the number of years a person has stayed sober in the same way most people count birthdays. I never made it to my sweet 16. I started drinking again on my actual 60th birthday in May 2003. Perhaps, had I attended AA meetings over those 15 years following my stay at Hazleton, I wouldn't have started again. Who knows? Doesn't matter. It's now many martinis under the bridge. Barney and I were still considering a divorce, though no one else in our immediate world knew about it. I was still residing in Toronto to film Queer as Folk. With everything in flux, I had not given much thought to my approaching 60th birthday. family members began asking me about how I planned to celebrate. I finally chose a birthday bash weekend in Las Vegas for 30 guests with rooms at the Four Seasons. We chartered a private bus to drive most of us from Los Angeles to Vegas. On the way, we all viewed my favorite movies and listened to my favorite music. Besides 3 days of gambling, we arranged tickets for all of us to go to Cirque du Soleil, as well as dinners in the best restaurants. The night of my birthday dinner, we all gathered at a restaurant where Barney had reserved a private room. As was his custom, he sat me at the head table with my brothers on each side of me. Before dinner was served, I leaned over to Michael and whispered, "Will you ask the waiter to bring me a martini?" He never batted an eye. "With pleasure," Michael responded. As the evening progressed, I happily sipped on my one martini. I never ordered a second one. Not one person in the room noticed there was a drink in my hand. I hadn't held one for 15 years. Since the birthday martini didn't change my personality, I convinced myself that I could have an occasional drink and be perfectly fine. I was sure that all of the cautions I had learned at Hazleton didn't apply to me. There's a reason it's said that denial is the primary roadblock to recovery. I thought a little cocktail detour would be a harmless way to improve the landscape of my life. And honestly, it did. I had a lovely time drinking again. No one else in my life seemed to have a complaint about it. My having one cocktail seemed to be acceptable in the social drinking realm. One summer break, between seasons of Queer as Folk, I returned to Miami with the intention of figuring out the details of the end of my marriage. It was time to divide the spoils. Barney said, "Your job is to bring 2 pads of paper and 2 pens. We sat at a table in our Fisher Island apartment, legal pads in hand and a long night ahead. "Before we start," I offered, "I owe you an apology." Barney looked up from the notes he was jotting down. "What's that?" I said, "As you know, I never thought I was pretty. But recently I found photos of myself as Cagney. I looked at one and thought, gosh, I really was pretty. At least in a photo. I know what I look like now, and I want you to know that I'm sorry for what I did." Barney got tears in his eyes and said, "Sharon, I was a poor Jewish boy from East L.A. All I ever dreamed about was a beautiful blonde shiksa. I finally had my dream, and within a year you were gone." I said, "I'm sorry, Barney." He replied, "I'm sorry, too, for being so shallow." It wasn't as if we allowed the marriage to crumble without trying to fix it. We saw many relationship counselors for couples therapy over our first 10 years together. During regular therapy sessions, we'd be horrifically spiteful to one another. It was safe to let it all come out with the therapist in the room, but it was a little scary how mean we could be. Oddly, following each hour-long session when we were alone, we would be the kindest we had been all week to one another. Someone highly recommended a special couples therapist to Barney. I agreed to go, though it was an hour drive from where we lived. The counselor's office was in a small pool house behind his regular home. The pool was only about 10 inches from the side of the garage. There was no other walkway to get to his office. We had to shimmy sideways the length of the pool, our backs hugging the wall to not fall into the water. Barney was already looking apologetic. I didn't say a word. The therapy session was equally ridiculous. We had to play word association games for an hour. I didn't dare look at Barney. At the end of our session, the therapist got a very serious look on his face, leaned in and said, "May I ask you both a question?" We both said, "Sure." With complete seriousness, he inquired, "Do you know Al Pacino?" I'm sure the look on my face reflected my thought. What? What did you just say? Finally, I spoke up. No, I do not. Barney? I turned to stare at the side of Barney's face. He somehow held it together. No. No, I don't. We left, silently scooting sideways along the garage wall to get back to our car. Once the car door was shut, I looked over at Barney. Al fucking Pacino? Do I happen to know Al fucking Pacino? Don't ever do this to me again, Barney! He didn't. One of the last couples therapists we saw wisely said, if I were to give you a relationship diagnosis, I would say that this marriage is over. Barney and I both stopped talking. This wasn't what we expected. The therapist explained, the truth is, he said to me, you fell in love with Barney because he was powerful, and power is a great aphrodisiac. He made things happen for you. He was the boss. He's not that anymore. Then he turned to Barney. And you fell in love with Sharon because she was beautiful. She's not that anymore. We sat silent. He continued, the reasons you came together as a couple no longer exist. So what are the two of you going to do? We had no answer to his question. The therapist said, what I would suggest you do is either call it quits in a kind manner and be done with it all, or when you leave here, go out this door and introduce yourselves again. See if you like one another as you are today. You may. You may not. It was heartbreaking, but true. We walked down the hall and got into the elevator. Someone else got in the elevator with us, but I didn't care. I extended my hand and said, hi, I'm Sharon. Barney took my hand. He said, I'm Barney. We softened after that. We rested from battle. We measured our words more often. We made room for possibility. We left our divorce date off the monthly planner. The weeks passed and the calendar pages turned. A year turned into another year. In the same way I was in no hurry to get married, I was in no hurry to get a divorce. It's one thing to lose a marital status as a matter of record. It's a whole other thing to lose your very best friend. I will continue to love Barney forever. And I know he loves me. To this day, he still refers to me as his big deal. Eventually, my delusional, I can have one drink detour, became two drinks, and then three. The booze began to turn on me around age 67. I would go into blackout, usually after three martinis. I was still able to function, though not always appropriately, so no one else could tell that I was in blackout, including me. The next day, I never remembered what I had done or said the night before. I would eventually hear from others about the socially inappropriate travesties I had committed, like the evening I joined strangers at their table in a restaurant and ordered food on their bill. I spent the entire evening with them. From what I was told, my chosen table mates found me to be charming company and apparently had no issue with picking up my tab. I'm sorry I never met them properly. The problem was I had deserted Barney and the couple we had actually invited to dinner at our own table across the restaurant. I would wake up on some mornings to find Barney staring at the ceiling. I'd say, good morning, with a smile. He'd reply softly, do you have any memory of last night? I would admit, no, I didn't think so. It seemed I was constantly apologizing for things I couldn't remember. My drinking had become unpredictable, and at least for others, embarrassing. I won't bore you with the details of other individual incidents we've all seen absolutely fabulous. Although in alcohol's defense, I've done some pretty stupid stuff while completely sober, too. I have a video of my incredible and lavish 70th birthday party, thrown on a high-rise rooftop in downtown Los Angeles. I cringe at the progression of my drunkenness, shown on the video from the celebration as the evening goes on. No one appears to be bothered by it, but who knows what was edited out of the reel. Everybody loves the fun party girl until she yells at one of the guests, "I don't give a fuck about your kids!" Oops. Shortly after that birthday party, I had my first severe pancreatic attack. My body was giving me a red flag warning. After my second attack, it was obvious that my body would now be directing the show, and my 10-year intermission as a drinker was over. I quit. Cold turkey. One day, about a year later, a friend of Barney's asked me why I had decided to get sober again at this point in my life. I didn't want to go into the medical history of the pancreatic attack, so I answered, apparently there were complaints. Barney tipped his head back and roared with laughter. My book title was born. Forty-five. Characters Welcome. "Congratulations, you're going back to work," my manager Perry Zimmel told me by phone. "Burn notice sold." "What's burn notice?" I asked. I meant it. Then it all came back to me. Soon after filming the final episode of Queer as Folk in 2005, I shot a pilot for a new TV show by Matt Nix. I thought the writing was clever. Even though it was a drama, I laughed out loud while reading the script. My scenes had been filmed over the course of 2 days in Miami, while I got to stay in a hotel with the other actors and collected per diem. It seems I forgot to tell the producers that they didn't need to put me up since I have an apartment in Miami. It's way too much fun to hang out with the cast and crew when the workday is over. 7 months had passed since filming that pilot. I'd forgotten all about it. But now Perry was telling me that USA Network had picked up the series. My God, it sold! I had a new job and a fresh series, and the entire filming would be done in Miami. I guess it was only right to tell the producers that I lived there. I would be playing the mother of an international spy, sexily played by Jeffrey Donovan, who was fired by the CIA, given his burn notice. He had been drugged and dumped in Miami where his mother, Madeline Weston, lives. It was original. No other TV or film spy had a mother. The closest thing was James Bond's relationship to M, played by Judi Dench. Not so bad. I wasn't exactly jumping up and down to play a mom again. I thought the mom role of Debbie Novotny on Queer as Folk would be hard to beat. Lucky for me, this burn notice mom was unique. She was described as a chain-smoking hypochondriac. The slogan of the USA Network at the time was, "Characters Welcome." I didn't want to disappoint. I decided to play her full out. Matt Nix created the character and the storylines. I created her look. I thought she should fit the category of a stereotypical Miami matron, which at that time meant a wardrobe of white capri pants and long gem-colored blouses. Her earrings had to be big and match the colors of her clothes. I wanted her short hair to be pure platinum, no highlights and no lowlights. Being on a budget, I figured she was a one-dump color-from-a-box kind of broad. In the first episode, Madeline, who hadn't seen her son for 10 years while he was on a long secretive mission, demands that he drive her to the hospital. "Just because they can't find anything wrong with me doesn't mean I'm not sick," she tells him, taking pills by the handful. When her hypochondria symptoms don't work to control her son, she resorts to other methods, such as telling him there's an emergency at her house. He rushes over to find that the emergency is her malfunctioning blender. She is horribly and hysterically manipulative. I called her the mother from hell. As the show progressed, her involvement became richer and sometimes darker. I enjoyed being able to smoke full-time again, on and off camera, and was soon up to 3 packs of Marlboro Reds a day. The crew even pumped smoke from a fog machine onto the set that was Madeline's home, reinforcing the joke. What was originally supposed to be only an occasional appearance by Madeline turned into scenes in almost every episode by the second season. The viewers loved the relationship between Madeline and her son. It was funny and tough and sometimes sad. A dream acting job. In 2008, during a hiatus of Burn Notice, I got a phone call from Ryan Murphy, the creator of Nip Tuck, the hit TV show about the lives of two plastic surgeons. He said he'd seen my guest appearance on the talk show The View. Ryan had come up with an idea for what he described to me as the sickest character he had ever dreamed up. He felt I would be perfect for the role. I was flattered. He first asked if the black suit I was wearing on The View was an Armani. Yes, I lied. Do you actually need the large, round, black-rimmed glasses you were wearing? Only to see with, I answered. Good, he said. I want you to wear that suit and those glasses for this character. Have you ever seen Misery? Ryan wanted to know. I said, not only have I seen it, I created the role of Annie Wilkes on stage in the West End of London. He was happy. Then you're familiar with insanity. Very. He asked, do you know Nip Tuck? Of course I do, I lied a second time. My friend Rosie O'Donnell's been on your show. It's great. The part is yours if you want it, Ryan assured me. I'll write it for you. That weekend, I stayed up around the clock and watched 24 episodes of Nip Tuck in a row. I got hooked. It was wonderful. I'm not lying. I went off to film 4 episodes of Nip Tuck as soon as Burn Notice went on its first hiatus. My portrayal of Colleen Rose, the psycho villain who weasels her way into the life of one of the plastic surgeons, earned me my 9th Emmy nomination. I didn't win. I've never said this in my entire career, ever. But I should have won for that performance. One morning, during a subsequent Burn Notice hiatus, Barney and I had an argument. We always got along better when I'm working. If I'm not busy, I get restless and start buying stuff out of catalogs or eating ice cream out of gallon containers. An addict is an addict. I was scrolling through emails at my little desk next to the kitchen. Barney appeared at my side, tossed a page from the Sunday New York Times on my keyboard, and said, if you had any balls, you'd go after this. Since he was already out the door to play tennis, I snapped back to the empty room. Don't challenge me! I read the article, Sex and the Single Senior. Jane Juska, an English professor at Berkeley, had not been touched sexually in 30 years. She decided to take out an ad in the New York Review of Books to find a man of her intellectual equal for the purpose of having sex again. It read, before I turn 67, next March, I would like to have a lot of sex with a man I like. If you want to talk first, Trollope works for me. 63 men responded to the ad. She had sex with some of them and had written a best-selling book about her experience, A Round-Heeled Woman, My Late-Life Adventures in Sex and Romance. 30 minutes later, I called my attorney on that Sunday afternoon and said, option this book for me, please. I gave a copy of the book to Jane Prowse, a wonderful British television writer whom I had met while performing in Misery. She fell in love with it and agreed to write the stage adaptation. She took it to Brian Eastman, who bravely came on board as producer. Brian had previously produced Misery in the West End. The three of us became inseparable. When Burn Notice would go on break from filming, I would do a production of A Round-Heeled Woman, first as a premiere in San Francisco, and then the next year in Miami at Gable Stage. The show sold out nightly. The run was extended. Most of my friends in Miami, including Matt Nix and some of the cast and crew of Burn Notice, came to see me in the show. Jeffrey Donovan refused to attend. I cannot watch a play where my mother is masturbating on stage. I just can't do it, he explained. I couldn't argue with him, since the play opens with me having phone sex and later multiple orgasms while standing up. That skill is not listed on my acting resume. Based on our Miami reviews, we were invited to play London's West End. We started at the Riverside and then were invited to the Aldwych. The Aldwych is a classic old theater in the best and the worst ways. It had housed the Royal Shakespeare Company for a generation. I had Dame Judi Dench's dressing room, which was on the stage level. It was an elegant space, with an outer sitting room for the guests after the show. On the downside, it had no bathroom. The women's restroom was up 7 flights of stairs. 7! Well, that's not going to happen. There was a large, deep sink in the inner dressing room. I realized I had a small footstool and could climb high enough to pee in the sink. One day, I confessed to my assistants, Deb Mosk and Daniel Thurman, what I was doing. But I assured them that every night before leaving, I sprayed the sink down with disinfectant. Daniel laughed and said, "Sharon, do you really suppose that you are the first actress to pee in there?" If we were ever to meet, I'll bet Dame Judi and I would become friends. After all, we probably pissed in the same sink. Toward the end of our Burn Notice run, Tyne Daly came to Miami to shoot an episode as our guest star. The two of us had a ball. She suggested that her character also be a chain smoker. In one scene, Michael enters Madeline House but can't even find us through the double amount of heavy smoke. It was a funny sight gag. Tyne and I would start the day in the makeup trailer together, rehearsing our lines and howling with laughter. It's what we always did. The first time Tyne and I walked onto the Burn Notice set together, there was a reverential silence from the crew. "Jesus, I never get this kind of respect when I walk in by myself," I complained. A crewman responded, "It's the two of you together." And still, whenever we are in New York, people on the street will call out to us, "Hey, Cagney, hey, Lacey." The most unexpected reaction was when Tyne and I appeared at the Democratic National Convention for Hillary Clinton in 2016. We all wanted her to go on to the White House. I love Hillary. We were robbed. Along with Tyne Daly, other top Broadway stars were there. Audra McDonald, Idina Menzel, and Brian Stokes Mitchell, among other notables, to sing "What the World Needs Now Is Love." When the camera panned to Tyne's and my two-line portion of the song, the convention center erupted. We were stunned. Cagney and Lacey, together again! Bigger than Broadway! What an evening! Tyne will sometimes say to me, "It's an honor to know you." The honor is truly mine. I'll go anywhere to see her perform, or, as is our tradition, have a hot fudge sundae together. I'd do anything for her. We are still very close to this day, and we check in with each other almost every morning by phone. Tyne's mother had an expression that I paraphrase: "Sweat makes a great cement." For 7 years in a row, I loved returning to play Madeline on Burn Notice. I received my 10th Emmy nomination for that show. USA Network was eager to give the show season 8, but I think Jeffrey, who never, ever got a break from shooting, was done. There were no days off for our leading man, as he was in every scene. They kind of killed the golden goose. I was the last actor on set during the last day of shooting the final episode of the show. Madeline sacrifices her life to save her last living son, Michael, and protect the future of her grandson. The bad guys are closing in. She knows this time they will kill both her and her family unless she takes action. Even though Jeffrey had completed his time on camera and didn't need to be there, he came in to do our final scene together, a long phone conversation where Madeline and Michael say goodbye. Jeffrey stood off stage to speak his lines, while the close-up shot was on me. He was there so I could hear his voice. We knew it was the last scene we would ever do for the show. His kindness was not wasted on me. Madeline had rigged her house to explode once all of the bad guys enter. Knowing that her own life will end as the house implodes, she says, "This one is for my boys." She lights her cigarette and flips the switch. It is over. As the shooting day progressed, I felt an ache in the middle of my chest. It started out gradually and never stopped. I began to worry, but I didn't tell anyone what was going on. I hugged Matt Nix and the crew goodbye. Late that night, when I finally got home, I told Barney about the pain in my chest. It wasn't disappearing. He insisted we go to the emergency room. They ran all the tests. The physician asked me about what was going on in my life. I told him that the show I was working on for 7 years had ended that night. The series family I had been a part of and had loved was finished. I described the intensity of my feelings throughout the day and the continuous pain in my chest. The laughter was over. My burn notice family was gone. I was given a diagnosis. "It's an actual ailment," the cardiologist told me. "It's called broken heart syndrome." The Wish. A thunderstorm blew across South Miami tonight. The lightning cracked the sky all the way down to the horizon, right before the dark clouds dropped torrents of rain. There's an electrical charge in the air during a storm, which I believe holds great power. I always make a wish on that energy, hoping that it might become a reality. I know my wishes are always heard. Sometimes what I ask for is what I get. Other times, I get something I didn't realize I wanted. Like that bolt of lightning, something I never wished for enters my life. It was never my wish to write a book, ever. In 2013, I was invited to a meeting at CBS where all the brass were present, the heads of comedy, drama, and new series. "Welcome home, Sharon," said the president of entertainment. "Wow, okay." For 1 hour, I told the group of TV decision makers some of the stories from my life. They smiled, they laughed, they listened intently. I had them in the palm of my hand. I had walked in eager to talk about the possibility of a new TV series. I walked out with a book deal to write my life story. What? Apparently, they thought the stories that came to me so easily in that CBS office would translate quickly to the page. But in fact, it has taken me 8 years, from book contract to bookshelf. Here's the deal. I'm an actress. That's what I do. I know how to be in character. But how to be in Sharon Gless and put it in writing on the page? That was a different story. Being free of alcohol, drugs, and cigarettes and doing my best to corral my cravings for carbs made it seem even more daunting. Every story I wrote became a mirror, with no smoke or inebriated focus to blur the reflection. Every memory magnified elements of myself I had never taken the time to define, from my determination to succeed to my deep self-doubt. From my shyness in social interactions to my drive to entertain the masses, from my eternal optimism that I will know what to do and how to do it, to my ever-present feeling of not being enough. Then there was the overall fear of being boring and yet having the balls to do it anyway. I realized that I have seldom felt as though I belonged, in adolescence, in adulthood, or in life. Socially, I have always felt like an outsider. The only time I was sure of myself was when I was playing someone else, when I could shapeshift, slip into someone else's skin, and hide in plain sight. It's okay, I'm in therapy. It's probably something most actors share, the sense of belonging only when we are in character. I found Sharon Gless to be generous and needy, forgiving and flippant, one who persistently preserves the past with diligence and has equally walked away from something she valued to avoid confrontation with others. I am loyal to those I love and as lonely as a foster child left on a doorstep. I've discovered that the one consistent love of my life has always been my acting career. It is my descendant, my own growing child. I've cherished and nurtured it for 5 decades. I've never had a gimmick or a killer body or drop-dead looks. I have no university degree in theater or film. I speak only one language, albeit in a husky voice, which I'm told is recognizable. I am genuinely a stranger to the actor's practice of craft and technique. Like all of life, I go with my gut. I'm clueless about the structure of a script. I do, however, know if it doesn't feel true. My best trait is that I will forever be a willing and enthusiastic student of this filthy business. Somehow I learned to put it all together, and it worked for me, despite an occasional complaint. No matter, even the complaints, more than the compliments, helped form me. Most were accurate. Some were funny. No. Some hurt me. And some just made me angry enough to win anyway. Over the past 50 years, I have been able to churn out a number of memorable performances. As for the many women and the one man I've played, it's been an honor. Tonight's downpour of rain reminded me of the very first time I absolutely knew to my core that I belonged in this business. It wasn't during a thunderstorm. Los Angeles doesn't have many of those. It happened at Universal Studios in the 70s. Most nights I'd stay in my dressing room long after the day's filming had ended and the rest of the cast and crew had gone home. I loved being there, savoring the dark silence of 1 a.m. and the smell of the evening rain on the studio asphalt. I didn't have a driver in those early days, so I would take the long walk to my car in the darkness, guided by the lights on the corners of the now empty sound stages. I wouldn't see one other person as I made my way across the lot. Not one. Even the tower, which housed Lou Wasserman and all the other big executives, would be completely dark. Universal Studios was my private home late at night. I owned it, all by myself. They paid me every day to come to this make-believe world and perform. And every night I'd leave knowing that the next day I'd get to return to this place where everyone shared the same goal: to create magic on film. In the morning, Scotty, the gate guard, would welcome me back. My very own hair and makeup people would be waiting with all of the pots and paints set up to help turn me into someone else. I knew everyone, and they knew me. They cared about me. We laughed all day long. We were good at what we did. We made television. For 10 years, I was an MCA Universal Studios contract player. And remarkably, I was the very last one to leave the lot when the contract system came to an end. I am the last contract player in the history of Hollywood. A lucrative career waited for me on the other side of the Universal gates in 1982, thanks to everything I had learned from the studio people who taught me. Those years were my rosebud. Every story in this book is a memory of the people who influenced my life, the guardians of my childhood years, my siblings, my young girlfriends who shaped my humor, the men I've loved, most who stay forever young in my memory, the professionals who guided and nurtured me and took a chance on my career, and my fellow performers, most of whom I will always count as my friends. That's it. I won't take the long walk across my own story again. I'm more intrigued with the possibility of taking on another life, a new character, a new role. I look forward to meeting her and becoming her. This time, I'm going to live forever. So far, so good. Acknowledgements. In 2013, the president of entertainment at CBS was the visionary Nina Tassler. She invited me in to meet with her in L.A. I walked in thinking it would be about a TV series and left with an offer to write a book. It all started with you, Nina. Jonathan Karp, the president and now chief executive officer of Simon & Schuster, invited me to a meeting in New York. I read him one of my stories. The support staff in the next room started laughing. He handed me a book deal. Overwhelmed, I put it in a drawer for a year. Thank you, Jonathan, for your patience and this opportunity. Thank you to my manager, Perry Zimmel, who sealed this deal and pushed me when I needed it most. So how's the book coming? My deep appreciation goes to my editor, Karina Gooderman, who never questioned if I could do this, cheered me through the challenges, and only killed my darlings with the utmost kindness. And to LaShonda Anakwa, associate editor, it's been said, love is in the details. Thank you. Dawn LaFrieda is my best friend, who unfailingly has kept an ongoing list of the many stories from my life that I have told her over the last 15 years, jotting them down wherever and whenever a memory spilled out of me. From the beginning of our friendship, she insisted that I had a book to write. Her certainty became a reality, but not without her endless willingness to bring order to the memories, digitized photos, schedules, calendars, websites, people, places, and things that comprise my life. Her daily commitment to keeping me on track has been utterly heroic. She has always been a constant source of support and undying enthusiasm for my career and my biggest dreams. She is smart as hell. And when other people have to use Google for an answer to a tough question, I text Dawn. She's faster. Also, if she had a dime for every time she has had to use Find My Phone app for me, she could buy another Denny's restaurant to add to the 85 she already owns. She runs an empire and still finds time for me. I don't know how I got so lucky to have her in my life, but I won't be cashing out anytime soon. There aren't enough ways to adequately thank you, Dawn. You already know how much I love you. I raise a glass of Sprite in gratitude to my very dear friends Sandy Lifson, Vivian Radcoff, and the larger-than-life itself, Renee Taylor, for reading various versions of this book and always cheering me on, except when they didn't like something. To my brother Michael, the attorney, for telling me his version of our childhood, and for keeping me out of prison. And to my brother Eric, the architect, for faithfully assembling all of our family's history records. The two of you are the surviving witnesses of my childhood and younger years. If any memory in this book doesn't match yours, keep it to yourselves. I love you both with all my heart. To my cousin, Elizabeth Bauer, your memories were my memories. You were the sister I never had, and I'll always be a better person for it. I miss you in so many ways. To my niece, Bridget Glass Keller, thank you for keeping a chronicle of my career when you were a teenager, for all of the photographs and the very scary career memorabilia, and for organizing it all for me. I love you, Buck. To my erstwhile very personal assistant and loving stepdaughter, Aline Rosenzweig, for never deserting me. You did it all with a smile on your face and a kiss on my cheek. Thank you, my sweet girl. Carol Smith, you are so much more than our longtime assistant. You are family. You have seen us through it. Thank you. To my psychotherapist, Dr. Barbara Rose Ponzo, who has heard it all for more than 30 years and still takes my calls. Barney Rosenzweig, my husband, dared me to sit down and write 30 pages. He knows me so well. There would be no jump start without a challenge. He threw down the gauntlet. I had to pick it up. I always do. Some pages had only 9 or 10 words on them in 24-point font, but hey, it counted. Barney has rallied the idea of me as a memoir author from the get-go. He stayed the entire course as my daily motivator right to the finish line. He has read and reread every line of this book, never mincing his opinion, helping me to put on the page what mattered most. Obviously, a man who can produce a complete story with 45 minutes of TV time week after week for hundreds of episodes knows how to redline a manuscript. I was fortunate to have him clean up my meanderings. For your continuous encouragement and injurious feedback on each draft. Thank you, Barn. And finally, to Marcia Wilkie. There would be no book without her. If you didn't like it, blame her.
Apparently there were complaints. A memoir was written and read by Sharon Glass. It was recorded by Ian Mercell and Carlos Marcano at The Kitchen in Miami, Florida. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Claire Tatacoro. Apparently, There Were Complaints was produced by Tiffany Ferrari and directed by Marcia Wilkie. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Apparently, There Were Complaints, a memoir, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.